Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, I hope you had a jig. I hope you had a dance. I hope you had a bit of a walk around because we are now going to listen to the music, just as the great Doobie Brothers suggest. So this is the section which I call Music with Meaning. You're listening to real people in the psychotherapist chair with me, Jerry Pives. And Kim Knight, welcome back to our discussion of music that has meaning. So, Kim, I asked you for four pieces of music, roughly to represent maybe four different moments or periods of your life. And what's the first one that you've got lined up for us that you want us to listen to and share about?
So the first track that comes to mind and came to my mind when you suggested doing this was Sugar Sugar by the Archies. And I thought I was about 6 or 7 when I heard this song, but apparently it came out in 1969, so I must have been 8, but I thought I was younger. But I used to have this little record player, little portable record player, which I loved dearly. And we had a playroom at home, like lots of kids do. Like, you know, the kids can go in there and they can make a mess. And I used to love dancing around, listening to music on this record player. It was my special thing and my special prized possession. And my parents must have been having some work done on the deck outside, and they had a carpenter who came for, I don't know how long, whether it was a week or a few weeks. And one day he came in and he brought this record, Sugar Sugar. And I put it on and I absolutely loved it. And I would dance around the playroom. And then one day my brother pushed me over and I landed, either he landed or I landed on the record player and it broke. And I remember being absolutely distraught. And even back then, I remember one of the reasons that I was so distraught was that nobody seemed to apologize. Or, you know, there was no comfort or comforting. And I was really, really upset. Mm-hmm. And yesterday, when I was thinking about these four pieces of music, what I saw, which I'd never seen before, was I really feel that this carpenter saw that I wasn't a happy little girl, because I wasn't. I mean, there was a part of me that was happy, but there was a part of me that wasn't. And I really feel like he brought me that record to cheer me up. You know, that was his way of trying to give me some love and some comfort. And I just saw that yesterday when I was thinking about this music. And I actually felt really emotional yesterday. But the funny thing is, I can't remember why I was feeling emotional now, which is sort of weird and interesting. But that was the first music track that I ever remember. And obviously it had a powerful reasoning for me at the time.
Wow. That's a really vivid story that you've just shared. Thank you for that. I don't know what it is about carpenters. I don't think it was entirely an accident that Jesus chose carpentry as his profession, because every time I've come across a carpenter, they've always been, I don't know, just a bit more grounded than I ever was. I remember I worked for a theatre company, 19, 20 years old, and we created a show. We were touring internationally, and we was very young, and it was experimental theatre in the late 1970s. It was all the rage. And we built ourselves, we took our own theatre with us. So we had a theatre within a theatre. It was a tent. It was a wonderful tent construction. And we had a carpenter build these massive wedges that went by truck around from one venue to the other. And we toured all across Europe with this show. It was amazing. It was such an experience. But in the preparation, the training, we workshopped the show. So we created the show ourselves with a few ideas, and we kind of workshopped them. And it was really tough. I was young. I was confused. I didn't know who I was. It was all nonverbal, expressionistic physical theatre. It was, of course, it would be physical. That's why I was drawn to it, I think. And I just remember that in the intensity and the drama and the conflict of the group, the carpenter was working away in the room next door, making the show. And I used to go in there in my tea breaks, and he just used to soothe me with, he seemed to just know that he was a really upset young man and who didn't know his front from his back, you know. So this resonates with me, but something about this carpenter noticing you, you know, noticing you. And then that kind of, oh, well, it doesn't matter if her music gets taken away or her record player gets destroyed. You know, I can really resonate with that. And isn't it funny how sometimes music can bring up a feeling, and we don't know why sometimes. We don't know why. It's just, sometimes I feel like a whole world, I revisit a whole world with music sometimes, and I have feelings about that world. And I don't know why I have those feelings sometimes. But again, in line with our previous conversation, it's probably really important to let those feelings just bubble up, isn't it? And just to, and I think also moving is very important. And moving and being in your body. And yeah, I don't know why I'm saying all that, but I'm just really touched by that image, Kim. So we're going to listen to that, unless you want to say anything more.
The only thing, like you were just saying, it can bring up a whole load of memories, is that song really reminds me of that whole time, that whole age range of 6, 7, 8, you know, everything that happened in that time can sort of tie back to that song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you connect with yourself at that time, don't you? You kind of almost re-experience yourself.
A lot of visual memories come in immediately.
Yeah. And also some of the memories are what you'd call visceral or somatic. They're just the physical feelings as well as emotional feelings. It's like music somehow unites us. So I hope if you're listening, you're going to be inspired to put on some music and pick those pieces of music. It's great on YouTube now because you can pick a year on YouTube and you can find out what the top hits were.
No, it's interesting because as I was looking up on YouTube yesterday, and I don't listen to music on YouTube generally, and all these songs and albums started popping up, and I thought, wow, it would actually be quite good to just sit and listen through some of these albums, which I haven't listened to for years. And wouldn't that be interesting, and wouldn't that be healing?
Mm. So we're going to have a listen to Sugar Sugar by the Archies. And if you've got any remnants of a 5 or 6 year old still inside your body and your being, get up and let that 6 year old have a good old dance to Sugar Sugar. That was Sugar Sugar by the Archies. And you are listening to Real People with me, Jerry Pives, and we've got Kim Knight taking us back through memory lane with her music with meaning. Kim, what's your next piece for us?
So my next piece is Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven.
And why have you chosen that one?
Well, that came later when I was at, I think they call it high school these days, like sixth form in the UK. And
so 16 years old.
17, yes. And I think back at that time, the bands that I really got introduced to were Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. And I really like that music. I mean, there was others as well, like The Doors came to mind yesterday as well as another band that I used to listen to. And what came to mind immediately when I thought of that song was not just school, because I went to an amazing school in Gloucestershire near Cirencester for the last 2 years of my schooling, called Rencombe College. Have you heard of it?
Yeah, well, I went to school just down the road in Hereford.
Oh, okay.
I went to Hereford Cathedral School. And somewhere near us is the world-famous Cheltenham Girls College, where all the posh girls went.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I did go when I was looking at changing. I had interviews at various different schools around, you know, the area. Can't remember some of them now, but I only got offers to two of them, and one of them was Wrencombe. And they were primarily, they were a boys' school at the time with girls in the sixth form. And I had the best time of my life there. Just amazing people. We played a lot of sport. I used to play a lot of sport. And we just had fun. We were naughty. We'd go out drinking when we weren't allowed to. And I met the first love of my life, you know, quite early on in the 2 years that I was there. And he was the person, I think, that introduced me to Led Zeppelin. And we used to have these hymn books, and I wish I still had mine. I had a big purging at one point where I was just throwing away the past, and I think I gave away too much. But we had these hymn books that obviously we had to take into assembly every day. And he would always take my hymn book and write a song in it, or lots of songs. And often they were Led Zeppelin songs because he was really into Led Zeppelin. And so I had all these lyrics, you know, written through my hymn book of all these Led Zeppelin songs and Pink Floyd songs and whatever. We were still together when I left the school, and I went overseas for a year. I went to work in Switzerland for a year and had another fantastic time as well. But unfortunately, we parted ways, which was mainly my fault because I had a couple of flings when I was in Switzerland.
As you do.
Yeah. And I never, you know, I always intended to and wanted to be back with him. But a year is a long time, you know, to be away from your partner, especially when you're young. I've been watching Below Deck recently because I do like that, because I used to work on a cruise ship as well at a certain time. So I just love boats. And it's just interesting watching these 20, 30-somethings and how they behave and thinking, oh, yeah, I remember that. So I came back, and by then he was at Oxford University and I was at Reading University, and he just didn't want anything to do with me, really. I used to go and visit him occasionally, and I was tried so hard to get back together.
Oh, no.
And the really difficult thing, which I didn't realize for many years later, was that he never talked about it. We never got that completion.
Yeah.
Because we kept in touch, you know, off and on. And obviously being in New Zealand, I didn't see people very often in the UK. I go back every 5 years and go around and see all my mates. And he'd be on the tour list, so to speak, of catching up with people. But he very, very sadly took his life about 5 years ago. And I didn't know. I was reading the Rencomium newsletter, which comes out once a year. And I looked at this name and I'm like, it took me a while to really register the, you know, the death notices and that his name was there.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know that he was that unhappy. So all of that came flooding back, so to speak, when that track popped into my mind yesterday.
Yeah, that's it's a kind of body blow, isn't it, when someone that you once loved commits suicide. It has ripples, I believe.
Oh, yes. I mean, he was the love of my life.
Yeah.
I never had a relationship with anybody else like that.
No.
And we never got the chance to sort of complete it.
Mm.
And we were very, you know, soulmates, I suppose.
Yeah.
So very sad. I mean, not sad because I couldn't see him anymore, but sad to hear that he did that, and that he was obviously so unhappy that he felt the need to do that.
Well, let's have a listen. Well, you've just been listening to Stairway to Heaven by the famous Led Zepp, and that was Kim Knight's second choice, sharing with us her time in, well, really the time since her time at school, and also an ongoing connection and disconnection with a soulmate. So beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that, Kim. What third piece have you got lined up for us?
The third one is The Summer of 69.
And dare I ask why you've chosen this one for us?
Yes, well, this is a bit more lighthearted, really. And the story that comes with this was probably when I was at university, I think. And I'd gone home for a weekend, and I was going to go to a Bryan Adams concert that evening. and I decided that I was going to dye my hair blonde. It was sort of mousy brown, and I decided, right, I'm going to dye it blonde. So I went to the chemist, and back then the chemists were open on a Saturday morning, but they were shut Saturday afternoon, Sunday. And I think the concert must have been on the Saturday evening. So I go and get my hair dyed from the chemist and do my DIY thing. But I had misread that you actually needed two packets. You needed the packet that takes the colour out and the packet that puts the colour back in. So I only bought the packet that takes the colour out. And it turned it bright orange. So I'm there on a Saturday afternoon with bright orange hair, and I've got this concert that I am not going to miss, and the chemist was closed. I couldn't go back until Monday morning to get the right colour. So I made a decision, even though I was feeling so self-conscious, that I was going to go to the concert with this bright orange hair. And at the time, the clothes that I was into at the time were, it was quite a thing in the UK where you'd wear these sort of green army jackets, if you can remember. So that was my thing at the time. That's what I was into. So I had this bright orange hair and the green army jacket and my jeans probably. And I was going to the concert by myself. I don't quite know why, because I used to go to concerts with other people. Rolling Stones was one of the best concerts that I ever remember going to at Wembley. And so I went to this concert feeling so self-conscious. And the really weird thing was I got chatted up so much that night, and I couldn't quite understand why, but it was a great concert. I remember I was really into photography for many years, and I took these amazing pictures of Bryan Adams in black and white at the time, which I kept for ages. And that's what comes to mind when I think of that song.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Wow. That's a hilarious story, by the way. So what was going on for you at your life at that time when that concert was going on? What sort of period of life was this for you?
So that brings to mind really when I was at university. So I was at university for 4 years at Reading, and I actually went to study modern languages. I went to study predominantly French and German, because when I was at school and everybody was deciding what they were going to do when they left school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And this was all part and parcel, I found out later, of just being really traumatized, unhealed trauma, being very disconnected from myself.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know that at the time, but I felt it was so difficult, you know, knowing what to choose to do when I left school. So I thought, well, what do I enjoy doing? And everybody else seemed to be going to university. So I thought, okay, well, I'll fill in an application to go to university. And well, what do I want to study? Well, what do I enjoy doing? Well, I love languages. And so I went to Reading to study French and German. And in the first year, we had to take 3 subjects. So I had to add something else in. So I chose Italian. Had no interest really in learning Italian, but I just had to choose something. And then as I was going to classes, I found that the German and the French departments were so boring, and we were having to learn old German. I mean, we had to learn modern German and modern French, but we had to learn old...
Hochdeutsch.
No. Well, Hochdeutsch is just normal German, but I'm talking, yeah. But you had to learn old German, what they spoke in the 15th century, right? Oh. Which is very different. And I'm like, well, what's the point in that? I'm not going to go out in the world and speak 15th century German. And so a lot of the subjects that we were studying in the German and the French course, I just thought there's no point to this. It's not relevant. It's not real.
Good old academia, right? Don't we love academia? Let's give them something totally useless to study.
Yeah. And I found that the departments were very conservative and very sort of prissy and boring. And I just thought, yeah, the Italian department are really, they're really cool. They just had these really cool tutors, and we didn't have to learn old age Italian. It was just modern Italian. And I thought, right, I'm switching my degree. And so I switched to Italian. I had no idea how I was going to use it. It would be useful, but that's what I decided to do. And I spent a year in Italy as part of that, which was a pretty interesting experience because I chose to go to a place called Padova, because there weren't many English people there and I wanted to really immerse myself in the language. And I'd already done 2 years of training at university. I thought I could understand a little bit of Italian at least. But when I landed in Padua, I couldn't understand a word. Everybody was speaking so fast. And it was really difficult because I didn't know anybody who spoke English. The Italians didn't speak English. And then I bumped into this guy, one other English person that I met, and he was sort of like a bit of a, what's the word? He smoked a lot of dope. He was a lovely guy, but that was all he did all day. He just smoked dope.
Dope
but
head.
Because I was so, I was so desperate to talk to somebody that I hung out with him for a while, and I'm grateful for, you know.
So he wouldn't have introduced you to too many people except maybe his dope supplier.
Yeah, that was about it, yeah. But at least I got to communicate with another human being.
Yes.
Yeah, so the first 3 months were very difficult and then I came back to the UK and I didn't want to go back after the break. That was at Christmas. I just didn't want to go back. I was so miserable and I had to go back. So after a month, I got back on the plane, was walking down the steps of the plane when we landed and I understood everything. It had all integrated in that time of not having to think about it. It was like magic.
Wow.
It's very interesting. Yeah. And then I had a great time the rest of the year.
That's amazing, Kim. How the brain needed a month rest, really, just to assimilate it all.
Yeah. And I mean, overall at university, I spent most of my time playing sport. I didn't do much study. And then I got to the end of the, you know, our training period where we had just a few weeks before finals. And I thought, oh, my God, I really better pull my socks up because there's no way I'm going to fail this because my dad had been paying, you know, for accommodation. And I'm like, I cannot let my family down, my dad down. And so I really hunkered down and just studied nonstop. 6 days a week from 8 in the morning till midnight. And there were 2 complete courses out of the 9 courses that we had done within the Italian degree that I had not gone to any lectures for. I had 2 complete courses to catch up on. And honestly, I don't know how I did it. One was history of art and I can't remember the other one. And so I really studied hard for, I don't know, about 2 months and then passed with flying colours.
Woohoo! Amazing, amazing. I've got a theory about education is that the less formal education you have, the better. My own journey was in the sixth form. I taught myself history at O-level because I just thought I could get another O-level here. I have to say, I'm embarrassed about this now, but I saw some of the less intelligent members of the school doing their history homework because I was a boarder for my fifth form. So I was in boarding school in Hereford at my fifth form, which was actually a liberating time because I could escape and go to the pubs and the tutors had no idea where we were. And so I had a lot of beer and cider in Hereford pubs at that age. But I also, I remember looking at the slightly, you know, less bright members of our class and they were just learning some history and, you know, I thought, that's easy. You can read up a bit of history, you can answer questions and you can pass. I'll get another GCSE. It was O-levels then, but we call it GCSE now. So I taught myself history and told a slightly surprised history teacher that I wanted to be put down for history O-level. And they just like, I didn't think you were doing history. I said, no, I've done it myself. And then I passed that with flying colours, but in the process became so excited at learning how things were and where things came from. I didn't come from a very academic family. And then in my 2 years of A-level, towards the end of my first year, I got expelled. And I just applied to Oxford on my own and got the school to validate my application. I don't think anyone really realised at Oxford that I was not even at school. So I remember going to interview at Oxford. You know, now I look back, I must have been the only geezer who went for an Oxford interview, and he actually didn't even go to school. It was like...
Wow. Did you go to Oxford University?
I did.
Wow.
I did. I got in. I had no idea, because I can vividly remember in the interview, I still think they actually chose me for entertainment value. That's what I think, because I turned up in, I'd been working with my theatre company, and the day before they'd all said, God, your hair's too long to go to Oxford. And they were all laughing about it because they thought it was a hoot. I thought it was a hoot. I didn't think I stood a chance. And so they said, oh, let's do an experience. We were into theatrical experiences. And they said, close your eyes. And they all had clippers. There were three of my mates, so-called mates. And they said, you shout start, and then you shout stop, and that'll be the moment. That'll be the haircut. So I shut my eyes. I thought this was a great idea. You know, real life experiences, you know. So it was like a moment, a happening. A happening was the words we used to use. This was going to be a happening. So there I am the night before my Oxford. I'm in Cardiff, which is where the theatre company is, and I've got to catch a train to Oxford. And it's like... I close my eyes and I say, go. And then they snip. And then I say, stop. And then they picked up the mirror and it was a disgusting mess. So then I had to just shave my own hair off completely. There was no way around it. I just took the whole lot off. And I was into wearing grandfather shirts, you know, the collarless shirt and braces and these great big bell-bottom trousers. They were all the rage at the time. They're actually called Oxford bags, hilariously, but they were really big bell-bottom type things. So I turned up in my bobber boots, my skinhead haircut, and my braces to my Oxford interview. And forget the tutors, the other kids, they're all dressed in their blazers and their ties, looking like trying to be grown up. And I've been touring Europe with this theatre company, so I didn't have to pretend to be grown up. I had a real job, you know. And so I was just turning up, and I sat in the waiting room, had about 8 seats, you know, and I'd be at one end, and right down the far end, the other 3 candidates would be sitting like I was toxic or something. And when I walked in, there was this kind of chortle from the 3 dons that were interviewing me, you know. And they said, now tell us, Mr. Pives, why did you choose Magdalen? And I said, this is not meant to be about me, but I'm going to share it anyway. why did I choose Magdalen? I said, well, I love the writings of, what's his name now? God, a famous historian. I've forgotten his name. Oh, it's going to come to me later on. But he was a really... modern history writer. He kind of put the whole of the First World War down to railway timetables. He said that's what caused the First World War. And he had really interesting ideas. I loved them. They were so different. Anyway, he was an Oxford tutor. And I said, I'm really interested in learning from this guy. And there was this sort of awful silence after I said it. And you know with those silences when you've said something that has gone down like a lead balloon. And then there was another little titter, the shoulders started shaking with one of the tutors. And he said, well, that might be difficult because he left 5 years ago. So I hadn't even done my research, you know, you should have kicked a guy like that out right there. And then they said, well, is there any other reason? And you can see they were probably angling to see if I knew about their history work, you know, and that they're, because I didn't know a thing about the current lot, so I didn't know anything about them. So I looked up in the, and I looked out the window and I saw the deer park, because Magdalen College has the most beautiful deer park. It is probably the most, well, that and maybe one or two others, one of the most beautiful. And I'd really enjoyed walking through the deer park on the way there. So I said, well, I really like the deer park. At which point they just collapsed. They just roared with laughter. And you can just see, first he doesn't know who's actually teaching here. And then he's coming to our you know, Oxford Ancient College because of the bloody deer. Oh, and I did ask the tutor why they chose... I met him about, it must have been 10 years ago. He died now, but he was a lovely man, a very gentle soul. And I said, why did you choose me? And he said, oh, we once you got to interview, we weren't worried about your academic side. It was, we wanted to choose people that could, as it were, all get on together. I was eating soup with him at the time. I spluttered my soup. I thought, my God, they had no idea. These dons have no idea about people, about what makes people tick, about... There's no way I was going to get on with any of my fellow students. I couldn't have been less integritable than anything you could imagine. So that was just really funny.
It's hilarious. That's amazing. And you studied history.
I did. And I still think that was probably one of the most valuable trainings for psychotherapy, actually, because I do think, like you were, I mean, this is what you were saying earlier, that it all comes back to there's a reason, right? There's a cause. People don't just get sick, at least the vast majority don't. And there's a history, there's a story, and there's a reason. And very often my work is simply uncovering the past.
And a name that pops into my mind just as you were speaking, or just at the end there, is David Hughes, who is sort of becoming quite well known at the moment. He's a historian and done heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps of research into history, but like real history, because a lot of history that we're told actually isn't the real history. And the history that he has, you know, gone into over the last 100 years and written about in his books is quite amazing. And I think he might have been at Oxford.
He was an Oxford guy, and he was interviewed recently here on RCR. So go on it was the Paul Brennan show, and look up David Hughes. Really, really good stuff.
Yeah, I think I sent an email to RCR recommending they interview him some weeks ago. I don't know if that had an effect.
Well, we've been talking about university. We've been talking about, well, I've forgotten what you were talking about. I got so caught up in my own story, Kim. I forgot what you were talking about.
University in Italy.
Italy, that's right. Do you still speak Italian now?
I don't really have a use for it, but if I had to speak it in some way, it would come back. But German was always my best language. I mean, I did used to speak all three fluently, absolutely fluently, but I don't anymore.
No. No, but you probably would if you went back and spent time in those countries, right?
Absolutely, yeah. More, maybe.
Well, thinking linguistics and university times. I wonder what your university life was like, or what time you had when you went to college, if you went to college. But we're going to reminisce and play Bryan Adams' The Summer of 69. Well, that was Bryan Adams and Summer of 69. Kim Knight, we're on to our last piece of music with meaning. What have you got lined up for us and why?
Right. So, You Are So Beautiful by Joe Cocker. And that was a song that I first heard in the 90s when I really started to deep dive into personal growth work. And I came across an organization called Key Seminars, who really did heavy duty workshops where you'd go for 3 days and you'd start at 9 and finish at midnight and then repeat that a couple more times. And it was really deep diving into your emotions and wailing and screaming and hitting pillows. And
this is the real 1970s encounter group style stuff.
Yes. And it was great at the time. I wouldn't do it again, but it was absolutely perfect for what I needed at the time. And and we'd be taken on these big, long, guided visualization journeys into quite deep spaces. And at the end of one of these journeys, and I think they probably used it more than once, they had the song You Are So Beautiful. Because it was all about seeing your inner self, your inner child, your true self, whatever, and really coming to love that part of oneself a lot more. So that's what I remember about that song. And I have to say, it still comes back to me now and again. And I have a picture, a really lovely picture of me when I'm maybe 3 or 4 years old. And it's the most gorgeous picture that I've got of myself, I think. And when I look at it, I look at this gorgeous little girl, and I can't imagine why somebody would not love that child. And I think this probably, you know, should go for every child. But the point being that, you know, I grew up, unfortunately, in a situation where I didn't receive love in the way that I would have liked, and in fact received quite a bit of emotional and verbal abuse. And I suppose it would be called emotional neglect, which is a very hard thing to talk about and to even admit that one's parents are doing that to one. And of course, it's not that they're doing it necessarily on purpose. It's just that they're doing the best that they can, and they don't know what they're doing even. But the point of it is that when that song comes on, and then, you know, and I think of that little me, and I frequently, you know, look at that picture and remind myself that I'm okay, that I'm beautiful, because I never felt that growing up.
Yeah, well, last week or a couple of weeks back, I spent a whole reflection talking about script and how we develop these ideas about ourselves because they are how we grew up. And although we don't like them, they're how we survived. You know, for us to think of ourselves as not good often enabled us to fit in to our family of origin, right? So if we were in a place where people didn't regard us well, the only way we could survive as young children was to agree with that and take that on and punish ourselves even. So we'd think bad thoughts about ourselves because that's all we could ever control. So we couldn't make the big people change their opinion. You know, you couldn't make your parents think differently. The child does everything you can to be charming and delightful and lovable as a child. We all tried our best, but when that didn't work, when it failed, and I just think that we have this, we set ourselves in stone almost before the age of five, you know, and so it becomes very hard to accept ourselves.
I mean, for myself, for sure, it is very, very clear that the reason that I looked at those pictures from, you know, I mean, as early as I can remember, any picture that I ever saw, I never liked it. I thought I was fat. I thought I was ugly. And it simply wasn't true. It felt completely true in my mind. It was not true in reality. And the reason was because I had deep self-loathing and self-hatred and self-rejection because of the rejection that I experienced. And so I just began to reject and loathe myself because that was what I received and experienced. But of course, we don't know that, as you say. And by the way, nobody ever told me this in any of the trainings really that I did, maybe a couple, but not as deeply and explicitly as I came to see just through seeing client after client after client, that everybody that I've ever worked with who's come in the door with chronic pain, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel, whatever it is, whatever chronic illness it is, it is always tracked back to what happened to you in the first 7 years of your life. And every time a client comes, I'm always like, okay, well, maybe this is going to be different this time. I'm open for it being a different reason. And there may be, you know, reasons that happen later in life too, but the core beginnings of it always are set up in those first 7 years. And I think personally, it's a major missing piece in people who are helping people with illness. Unless that is looked at, you're never really going to sort things out.
Absolutely. And I don't know that when you get these chronic conditions, part of the reason why I think allopathic medicine has been so pathetic and useless with chronic conditions and chronic illnesses, one of the reasons obviously is the way in which they've been captured by pharmaceutical industry. But another reason is almost a determination in modern allopathic. The old-fashioned GP of the 1940s, for example, they knew, and they would see whole generations of families. You know, the doctor would deliver, you know, the children and then deliver their children. And so it was like the doctor saw these patterns of psychological, psychological patterns, really. I think that's the only word for it. And they'd see them, wouldn't they? And they, even if they hadn't trained in it, there was a wisdom in doctors in those days. And every so often we do a psychobabble show here on RCR. And I have Dr. René de Monchy, who's both, he was a GP and a psychiatrist. And he, you know, he talks about his GP training and the wise, wise old men and who taught him, you know, and the things, the wisdom, and they were almost philosophers, you know. And I think healing to some extent is also about that. It's about how deeply are you willing to look at yourself? Are you willing to think about what matters to you and what's important in your life?
I agree.
Kim, it's so open of you and lovely of you. I'm sure many listeners will really appreciate you sharing that about yourself and how hard it is. And I look at young men and young women and they're just beautiful. And very few of them are walking around looking like they know that. I often want to just stop them and say, you know, just stop for a moment and really enjoy how amazingly wonderful and beautiful you are. One of my favorite pieces of work to do with clients is to ask them to bring in a photograph of them when they're little and talk about how they feel about that photograph. It's just a lovely way of connecting with the innocence and often some of the pain. It's amazing what people see in their photographs of themselves. It's, they can see far more than I can ever because they know themselves. But it's a profound thing that you're talking about, is what is it we need to say to ourselves in order to accept ourselves and appreciate the gift of life and appreciate all the things that we have done and what we've lived through. Is that, how do we, what do we need to do to make ourselves okay?
In Ren Shui, we talk about the five essential qualities of the heart that need to be cultivated, which are trust, openness, love, gratitude, and deep respect. So initially, we start to cultivate those qualities just as themselves. So greater trust for ourselves, greater trust in others, greater trust in life, etc. But the ultimate goal is unconditional trust. So that means that one trusts no matter what. Now, that is very, very different from just having a little bit of trust. But it's so powerful and it's life-changing to be able to develop these heart qualities, because then no matter what is going on externally, we can manage our own state internally and feel good most of the time.
It's really lovely to talk with you about this material. Something about the heart, isn't there, that when you tune in to not just the physical heart, but the heart of who we are, and there's something profoundly spiritual in what you just said, that in some respects, trust is a profoundly spiritual aspect of being alive. And what do we trust and who do we trust? And there's a big question, eh?
Yeah, trust is huge, which is why it's the first of the five qualities that we cultivate them, you know, together. But they say that trust is the doorway to opening the heart.
Yeah. And just in case people missed what are the other four qualities, Kim? Just run those again.
Openness, which has a lot to do with acceptance. So unconditional acceptance of whatever is happening, of oneself, of others, which, you know, is one. Hears that, one can immediately see how powerful that is. Love, gratitude, and deep reverence and respect.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for sharing with us. We've run out of time, and I want to just say a really big thank you for sitting in the psychotherapist chair and sharing your music with meaning. How have you found being in the psychotherapist chair, just so the listeners know what it's been like for you?
It's been a lot easier than I anticipated. I thought you might have asked me a few really curly questions. So I don't think it's been very traumatizing at all. And as you say, I feel like we could talk for hours. We could just sit here and banter back and forth for hours and talk about so many interesting things.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I don't like to cause the people I talk with trauma. I think life's got enough trauma on its own, really. So I'd like to go the other way if I can. And I'm sure the listeners will join in with me in saying a really big thank you, Kim, for sitting with me. Well, that sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? Sitting with me in the psychotherapist chair. It's like we're sitting in the same chair. Let me start that again.
Good visuals there. Don't tell Ella.
Oh, God.
Are we editing this? Are we hearing it all?
I don't know. Sometimes these make the best clips.
Yeah, you should have outtakes. You know, like, what are they called? Bloopers, blooper reels.
Blooper reel, that's it, yeah. Okay, let me get, stop, be so hysterical. Well, Kim Knight, I'm sure the listeners will join with me in appreciating your openness and your sharing and your honesty. And really, your depth of understanding has struck me really powerfully, Kim. And it always does strike me about you. So we're going to bow out with Joe Cocker, You Are So Beautiful. And I'm sure the listeners will want to join with me in thanking you for sitting in the psychotherapist chair. Thank you, Kim.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.